So thank you very much for the introduction. Thank you very much to the conference organisers for the invitation to come here. Commiserations with the people involved in the fields for all the hard work that they've had to put in, but I'm sure from what I've heard it's been a very productive 6 months from their point of view, from everybody's point of view. And of course there's the Chalier to come in a month's time when many people will be back, and I'm sure that'll be another productive meeting. If it's as well organised as this one, then it should all run very successfully. Now, I always like coming to Canada. I think Canada's a lovely place. And what I like about it, well, one of the things I like about it is the deference they show to English people, to British people. So, dead queen in England, day's holiday in Canada. Right? Here's a cartoon, if this will work, from today's Globe and Mail, which my hotel delivers free. Okay? So, whatever the mathematical content from this talk, I expect you to go away impressed. Right, so what am I going to talk? Joke's over. Right? What am I going to talk about? I'm going to talk about bounds for the prices of variance swaps. So, I'm very lucky, because we've already had, well, several talks that have touched on what I'm going to talk about. Roger Lee, who isn't here now, so I can insult him as much as I want during my talk, he gave a talk on pricing of variance swaps and the use of Levy models, so models with jumps. And in fact, my main content is going to be about models with jumps. So there are definitely direct links with what Roger did. But various other people, Lane was talking about, well, suppose you know the prices of calls. From the price of calls, you can infer the density of the underlying under the pricing measure. And then Lane was talking about trying to model how that density evolves over time. So from that, I want to take the idea of using calls to infer the density of the underlying at some fixed future time. And then the other talk I really want you to think back to was Jan's talk about how you could use this information to potentially give yourself bounds, upper and lower bounds, on the price of derivatives. So you say, right, there are many models, and amongst those many models, you want to restrict attention to those which are consistent with the prices of calls on a given future date, and then amongst that set of models, you want to search for the model which prices your exotic in either the most expensive way or the cheapest way. And that's the philosophy that I want to take. And I want to do it for variance swaps, and I want to do it for variance swaps in the presence of jumps. So before we go to jumps, let's review what happens in the case where our underlying has continuous paths. So this goes back to Neuberger and Dupuy, and in this case, quite surprisingly, at least first glance, turns out there's a model-independent price for the variance swap. And the reason is Itô's formula. And so here we are. What you do is you take your price. Let's suppose it's a martingale. So let's suppose we're working on forwards here. We're going to take variance swap defined relative to forwards. Take that price, call it x. Take the log of x, apply Itô's formula. And what you find is that you get, as the finite variation term, exactly what you're interested in. So you integrate, and you get the payoff of the exotic. So I'm really just talking about the floating leg of the variance swap. We can always price constants. So the floating leg of the variance contract is some payoff that just depends on the time t law of our underlying, together with some, well, this is a hedging strategy. This is the gains from trade that you make from investing 2 over x in the underlying x at each time t. And so we've represented the payoff as something which we can synthesize using calls and a hedge. If we want the price of the payoff, then we can just take expectations here. X naught is 1, say. We just get expected value of minus 2 times log. And this hedge part, at least under a martingale assumption, will just disappear. So what you find then is that the price, and indeed the the price of the variance swap, is just something that depends on the terminal law of X, and therefore can be synthesized from X. So I want to tell that same story again, slightly differently, because I want to use these time changes in the future. So, well, I'm assuming that the underlying is a martingale. If it's a martingale, and if it's a continuous martingale, then you can write it as a time change Brownian motion. So I want to do the same calculations again, but I want to think about things, try and write them as time changes, and so on. So xt is just the brand new motion evaluated at the time change at, so I can just rewrite things. Then I can do a change of variable. Then I use dbs all squared is just ds. And now I do essentially Ito's formula for Brownian motion to give me this formula again. And again, the way to think about this is the price of my option. This is some hedging strategy, some representation of the hedging strategy. And this is a portfolio of call options that, provided I know call prices, or more particularly, provided I can buy today a set of calls, then I have a way of replicating the payoff from the option in terms of calls and this little bit of hedging strategy. And so, again, the price turns out to just depend on the expected value of minus twice times the log of some random variable, where the law of the random variable is determined by the call prices. From call prices, you can use Breeden and Litzenberger to get the implied density of the terminal price or the time t price, and then we just take some random variable with that distribution, take minus two logs, take its expectation, that gives us the price. So this is the sort of technique I'm going to want to use. I want to take my price process and I want to think about it as a time change of Brownian motion. And the reason that I want to do that is that, in principle, my price process could be a pretty general process, but it's potentially quite difficult to work with. In contrast, Brownian motion is an object that I've studied a lot, and we've all studied a lot, and we believe we know something about its properties and its behavior. So here's a problem that I'm going to make use of, and it's a classical problem going back to the 1950s called the Storr-Hodge embedding problem. And the idea is that you give me your process, and here we're taking Brownian motion, and you give me some distribution, and I'm calling it mu because, well, I'm going to think later about mu as being the law implied from my call prices. Ideally, or in one sense, what we want to do is to identify all the possible models for the price process for which we would have got the call prices that we see at time capital T. And by this time change, that corresponds exactly to finding all the possible ways of stopping my Brownian motion, so choosing a stopping time tau, so the stopped Brownian motion has that same law mu. And why is that useful? Well, if you want to search for the range of possible values of some exotic option conditional on the prices of calls, that's like searching over the range of possible values of some functional of a Brownian path conditional on the Brownian path being run up to some stopping time, where at the stop time, the Brownian motion has the given law. Now, for the variance swap, something quite weird happens. Doesn't really matter which way you write the functional, but it turns out that doesn't depend on the stopping time that you use. So I've spent a lot of the last 15 years thinking about this problem, and we have some functional of the path, say the maximum, and you're interested in how big can the maximum be, given the fact that you have a Martingale, and given the fact that you have some conditional, some law, some information about the law at time one. And so in that case, you find that the value of the derivative, the value of the exotic, does depend on the model, does depend on the stopping time that you use. But in this variance swap case, at least in the continuous case, you get this special result back to Neuberger, De Pere, but in fact, everything's model independent. That's fine, but there was one big assumption in there, namely that paths are continuous. Now, I am very happy to assume that paths are continuous when it's convenient for me to do so. On this occasion, given the story is sort of over for continuous paths, what I want to do now is to assume that the continuity assumption does not hold, and therefore I want to allow jumps and see what happens. Now, are there jumps in the market? Well, here's a plot of VIX. Well, who knows why things suddenly shot up? This is only a week or so ago, but something clearly happened. Maybe that was just changing market perceptions of what the volatility was going to be. Maybe that was some jump in the market. I'm sure somebody that knows more about these things than I do would be able to tell you one way or the other. Anyway, I want to ask the question, are there any model-independent bounds for the price of a variance swap in the presence of jump? Now, turns out that there are lots of, I mean, I've said what the question was, but there are lots of different ways you could precisely ask this question. As soon as you have jumps, it really does matter how you define the variance swap. Now, I'm going to define it in the way that looks mathematically nicest, because I have most chance of producing a nice theory in that setting. I think that's a good rationale. But you might criticize me for using what perhaps isn't the standard definition. It's not the definition used in VIX, for instance. But anyway, I'm going to take the squared increment and divide by the square of the current value at the start of the jump, potentially. And what I want to do is, given the prices of calls, so I'm only assuming I have prices of calls for a fixed maturity capital T, but I am assuming that I have a full continuum of calls at that point, so I don't get into the sort of issues that Jan was talking about what's the best way to synthesize log. Okay, I'm assuming I have the full marginals. Again, because that's going to give me the clearest mathematical question, which is what I'm interested in at the moment. So let's do something completely different. Okay, if you want to wake up again, not as much chance of sleeping given how loudly I talk, but if you want to wake up again, this is where the talk starts again, and then we'll try and show that this is indeed related to the question that I first posed. So take a Brownian motion, take its infimum, take its maximum. I'm going to start my Brownian motion at 1 because I want to think about positive processes, but I don't think that's really essential here. And if you think about it, if you think back to the variance swap, what I had was the integral from 0 to tau of, well, the Brownian motion raised to the power minus 2 du. And so what I'm going to do is replace the Brownian motion with its maximum and then ask how big, how small, in particular how small, can I make this quantity when I take expectations and when I look over the class of stopping times which would embed my mu. And I hope I've convinced you that if I can do that for the Brownian motion, then there is potentially some link back to the original question about the variance swap. Only it wouldn't be the variance swap because I have S instead of X. Right, so here's a little aside for the experts on this subject, of which there's at least one, excluding me, in the room. What's your guess for what might happen? I'll tell you my guess. So what we want to do is to somehow make S as big as possible, because that ought to make that integral as small as possible. How do you make S as big as possible? The atom of your solution. Does that make sense, Jan? It's wrong, but it does make sense. Right. Anyway, well, forget that. That was for specialists. So what's nasty here is we have this integral. It would be much nicer if we could turn it into something where things just depended, for instance, on the terminal values. And Ito's formula, again, turns out you can do that for this payoff. So let's look at 1 minus b over s all squared, take Ito's formula, and as if by magic, the term we're really interested in appears as the finite variation term. Or rather, there are two finite variation terms. There's also this nasty one. But in fact, this has been very cleverly chosen, even if I say so myself, because the only time when s is non-zero is when the maximum is increasing, and the only time the maximum can increase for Brownian motion is when the Brownian motion and the maximum take the same value. So we have something ds, but whenever ds is non-zero, it's multiplied by naught. So in fact, this nasty-looking term we can cross out, we can ignore. And so what we're left with is the term we're interested in. We integrate from the initial value, well, b and s both start from 1 in my notation, and so initial value of this is 0, up to the terminal value, plus some Monteagle term. But if I'm going to take expectations to get the price of this thing, then, again, the Monteagle term is just going to disappear. So I've been lucky, or I've really chosen a good problem here, because I've managed to convert the integral of 1 over s into something that essentially only depends on the joint law of the Brownian motion, which we know, and the, or at least its marginal law, and the maximum at the terminal time tau. So what I want to do is to try and minimize this thing over solutions tau of the Skor-Hod embedding problem for mu. So that's still a problem. I still may be able to make no progress with this problem, but here's a theorem. So I have some functional the maximum here. And so one might expect that the Asamoah solution, which maximizes the law of the maximum, would appear in my as my answer. It's certainly clear that whatever the optimal stopping time is, I mean, the payoff, if you like, only depends on the terminal value of the Brownian motion and the maximum at that point. So my stopping rule really ought to be something that just depends on the maximum and the stopping time as we go along. If it's not going to be Asamoah, the only other rule that I know is the Perkins stopping rule. So if at first you don't succeed, try again and be lucky. Right. So it turns out that if you take some objective function that only depends on the maximum, and if your objective function is increasing, then you can minimize the expected value of capital F of S tor amongst all embeddings of the terminal law mu by using what's called the Perkins embedding. So let me try and draw what this embedding looks like. So in fact, this is a really clever embedding because it does a lot more than what I'm saying on the tin here. What you do is you stop the first time that the Brownian motion either gets big relative to some function of its current minimum or gets small relative to some function of its current maximum. So this is involving the minimum and the maximum. You can sort of make it worse by just making it a function of the maximum alone. But very cleverly, if you choose the functions zeta and eta such that indeed you do have an embedding, then if your stopping rule takes that form, it will have the property of minimizing this thing. Now, various ways to prove this result, but if you go back and you try hard and you think about the proofs, it turns out that at least one of them involving Lagrange multipliers, allows you to think about more general functions that depend on both the Brownian motion, terminal value of, and the maximum of the process. And it turns out that as long as, well, you take the S derivative of your objective function, you divide by S minus B, you look, is that increasing in B? As long as that's true, then the Perkins embedding will indeed optimize this quantity. We'll minimize this quantity. So, I can't spell. If f is an increasing function of s, then fs is positive, and so divide by s minus b, well, as b gets bigger, s minus b gets smaller, that's in the thing on the bottom, therefore that quantity gets bigger. It's increasing in b. Okay, so this one certainly satisfies the hypothesis of my theorem, and so does this one. So, a few moments ago, I told you about a problem about Brownian motion. I've now told you the answer. The missing step is trying to argue that these two problems are related in some way. Well, I want you to think about our price process X as some time change of Brownian motion. Now, Brownian motion is a continuous process. So the way that you get jumps in X is basically by having jumps in the time change capital A. So I definitely want to allow for jumps in my process in my time change capital A. So let's take X and let's think about the minimum and the maximum of X. And I'm calling those J and R because they're letters adjacent to I and S. And remember that I've already defined the minimum and the maximum Brownian motion. Right, so here's a really trivial set of identities. X is smaller than its maximum, and it's bigger than its minimum. I hope there's no doubt about that. Now, the maximum of the Brownian motion, sorry, the maximum of the process, we'll think about substituting in BAT here, or sorry, BAS, and think about the maximum of the Brownian motion. Well, if the time change was continuous, then there would have to be equality here. But it is possible that your time change has a jump over the point where the Brownian motion has its maximum. And in that case, the maximum of the Brownian motion at time 80 could be bigger, or will be bigger in that case, than the maximum of X at that time. And something very similar happens down here. Okay, we can talk about the minimum of J. The statement of the Brownian motion run up to time at must be no bigger than J. And it is actually possible for it to be strictly smaller if at the moment the Brownian motion is getting its minimum, there's a jump in A, and so X never sees that part of the Brownian path. So, a really trivial set of inequalities. We're going to take the ones on the right-hand side. Start with, we're taking both here, sorry. So, what I'm going to do is say that, well, X is smaller than its maximum, and therefore X squared is smaller than its maximum squared, and therefore this thing I'm really interested in can be bounded below by this, and can be bounded above by something related to the maximum of Brownian motion. Let's concentrate on the lower bound, because that's what I've been talking, turn out that's what I've been talking about. Take the my version, or Dermond's version, of the payoff of the volatility swap in the presence of jumps, that's this thing. Bound it below by the maximum of the process to date. So that's a pretty crude bound, but it's a bound. And then, well, switching to Brownian motion, we get another inequality where we relate to S80, the maximum of the Brownian motion at the time change 80, and then do some time change and you get back to this quantity here. So if I now let AT be tau, that's exactly the thing that I've been minimizing so far. So if I want to talk about how low can this go, well, it's certainly bounded below by this thing, and then how low can this go? Well, I've told you the answer to that question. So plugging this all back together, we have that this will give me a lower bound, pretty crude, you might think, lower bound on the price of the variance swap. And this I know how to minimize by using the Perkins stopping rule. So we're finished. All I have to do is to try and, well, convince you that this bound is any good. And in fact, I'm going to do a lot more than that. I'm going to try and convince you that this bound is best possible. Okay, so you might think that I did some pretty crude things as we went along. And I did do some pretty crude things as I went along. But in fact, it's not possible to do any better. I can find a model where the price of the variance swap is exactly the expected value of this quantity here. Okay, so I haven't actually thrown anything away. Well, where was I potentially throwing things away? Well, firstly, I was replacing X with its maximum, and then with the maximum of the Brownian motion. And then secondly, I was using this Perkins construction to try and minimize that quantity. So if I'm going to find a model for which the bound is attained, I sort of know what sort of properties I need to generate from my model. And firstly, I need that if there's going to be a jump, it must be the case that just before the jump, the current price process is at its current maximum. Okay, because I mean, I have an inequality here, and I'm saying I want equality in my price, and the only way I can get that is by insisting that just before a jump, we're at the current maximum. And the second thing is, well, I use this Perkins embedding. In terms of what we're going to need, what are the properties of the Perkins embedding? Well, it turns out that the reason the Perkins embedding gives you the minimum is that for the stopping rule, if you ask when is the maximum above some level x, well, that happens in two circumstances. If the terminal value is above x, then clearly the maximum has to be above x. But if it's not going to be that the terminal value is above x, then we must have that the terminal value is very small, as small as possible. And this, on the board over here, can be re-expressed in a different way. And basically, the property that we're going to need is that places where the process has a big maximum are exactly the places where the terminal value is big, or the places where the terminal value is small. So I'm going to now try and use those two properties. So I want to construct some martingale. I'm going to change from X to M now, for no good reason. But I want to construct some martingale which has this property that if it jumps down from the maximum, and things about its terminal value that when the maximum of the martingale is big, either the final value is big or the final value is very small. So here's what I'm going to do. Let's see if I have the right picture. So I have an increasing function little f, I have a decreasing function little g. They both start at 1, and g, well, it possibly decreases down to 0, f may be unbounded, it depends on your terminal law. In addition, I have two other things, the main one of which is a uniform random variable. And what we're going to do is my process is going to chug along this line, f, until Lane's alarm clock goes off, which you can think of as hitting this random time u. At the random time u, I spin some coin. Sorry, I've got to get a uniform 0,1 random variable. So I generate a uniform 0,1 random variable, and depending on whether it's big or small, I either freeze where I am or I jump. Okay, so depending on this probability h about whether you freeze or you jump. Once this has happened, then I stay where I am. So I wait until some random time u, that gets me to here. I generate this other random variable, that tells me whether to jump or not. If I don't jump, then that's what the sample path is going to look like. If I do jump, then the sample path is going to go there, jump down here, and stay constant. There is only one jump in my martingale. And at the moment the martingale jumps, the process is at its current maximum. I hope you all agree with that. The second property I want is when my martingale ends up somewhere big, so when the maximum ends up somewhere big, think about the maximum crossing x, one of two things happen. Either the process is big, the process is above x, or the process is very small. The process ends up down here. And again, by taking f monotonic increasing and g monotonic decreasing, I get exactly those properties out. So I have designed a martingale. Well, it starts with the initial law. It starts at 1. There's a little bit to show you about how I'm going to choose these functions f and g. But take me on trust for a minute. I can choose f and g such that the terminal law of the martingale is indeed the target law mu. Moreover, not only can I do that, but I can do that and get the two special properties that I want. But if and when I jump, then just before the jump, I was at the prevailing maximum. And secondly, when is the maximum big? Answer, if and only if either the terminal value is big or the terminal value is very small. So there's a little bit of a gap here that I'm not going to fill, at least not very seriously, about how I choose these functions f and g. The one thing I haven't yet said is about this business about it being a martingale. Well, in order to get a martingale, I mean, I've got this process that at least until the jump is just sort of continually going upwards, and the martingale jump down essentially acts as a compensator. It essentially gives you the thing that nets off to make sure we have a martingale. So I can at least show you about how to choose h, how to choose the probability that you jump down at any given point. So what we want is that we have a martingale. So in other words, the expected value of the martingale evaluated at time u plus du, conditional information available at time u should be the expected value of mu. So let's condition on the event that my random variable capital U is bigger than little u, in which case my martingale has got to this point f. So here's my u. We've got to here. Then there are two things that can happen, although the second one divides into two subclasses, so maybe there's three things that can happen. The first thing that can happen is that nothing happens. Okay, your uniform Lane's alarm clock does not go off. In which case, we chug on to some slightly higher value, and, well, conditional on u being bigger than u, the law of capital U is a uniform random variable on 1 minus u through to 1, and so this is the chance that, in fact, the alarm clock didn't go off. Sorry, this is the chance that it did go off, and therefore 1 minus is the chance that it didn't go off. The other possibility is that the alarm clock goes off. That happens with this probability. And then there are two cases. I generate my second random variable capital V with a probability H, I jump down, and then I end up at G. And with a probability 1 minus H, I don't jump down, and then I end up at F. Okay, and now expanding out in terms of du. I'm going to get an f of u from, well, from this term on the 1, and then I'm going to get a load of terms involving du, and if you're quick enough at reading them, you can check that I haven't cheated here. It's this load of expressions. And so we need that to be 0 for the Martingale property, and that tells me that the chance of jumping down is some function that depends on the distance I'm going to jump and the slope of s, and, well, this is essentially some factor that appears from the fact that there's only 1 minus u time units to go. Okay? So that's the Martingale property. Let me show you another picture. I'm going to tell you how to construct f and g. Okay, I told you how to construct h, and I've actually given you at least an intuitive argument, I don't really have a better one at the moment, which shows that h is exactly what you want to get the Martingale property. Okay, I'm now going to show you how to construct f and g, but I don't have time to justify that it works. So what you do is you work out the put and call prices in your model, and this is not a model of a bubble, and so put's call parity holds. Okay, and I'm working in a zero interest rate world, so at 1, put and call price must in fact agree, and they must both be convex functions, and, well, P must start from north, at least in the finance context, and C, well, it ought to tend off to 0, but those aren't really important properties. So if you want to think about the uniform, it's got to be some, mu has got to be some random variable centered at 1, so let's think about a uniform 0,2 random variable as our example. It's about the only example you can do calculations for, but here are the calculations. Price of a port is k squared over 4 over 4, price of a call, again, some quadratic. So what you do is you pick some point z, and at least as long as everything is smooth, you take the tangent to p at that point z, and you look where that intersects the function c. Let's call that gamma of z. Then you form this quantity capital G, which is 1 minus something, and what's the something? It's basically the slope here plus the modulus of the slope here. Okay, now, as we go right, the slope here is going to get steeper, and the slope here is going to get steeper. So that's going to mean that g is actually going to be a decreasing function. Because it's a monotonic function, it has an inverse. That's going to be my little g. So this is going to be g of u, and then what's f of u? It's exactly this point. So I can do all the calculations for the uniform example. It turns out that capital G is square root of 1 minus z, f is 1 plus u squared, g is 1 minus u all squared. From that I can get an expression for h, which turns out something really simple. So I just wanted to show you that to convince you that there is a construction, and that this is not in the abstract, this is actually something one can in principle calculate. So, well, I've told you what the bound is. I've shown that the bound can be attained. It's a best bound. End of story. Not quite the end of story. I can do lower bounds by, see, if old technologies used to have certain advantages. If I had an overhead projector, I could just pick up my slide and turn it upside down, and that's essentially how you solve the problem for the upper bound. Okay, you just, rather than working with the minimum, you start working with the maximum, rather than having some process that grows and jumps down, you have something that comes down, I mean the functions f and g would change, but it would come down and jump up, and the whole story is exactly analogous. Essentially what we're going to do for the upper bound is to divide by the square of the minimum. We're then going to take an expectation over mu. So if our target law uniform 0,2, for instance, puts too much mass near zero, then just as log Z may explode if your target distribution has a lot of mass near zero, well, things are even worse here. Things are even more likely to explode. So in fact, the upper bound may be infinity, which isn't much of an upper bound, but if it's infinity, it's infinity. So, here are some numerical results. The only example we know how to do in closed form is for the uniform. So what I've got here is a family of uniforms. They're uniform 1 minus e to the 1 plus e, I guess, so that's my e. So there's a parametric family of uniforms. E takes some number between 0 and 1. And so the black line in here is, if that was the terminal distribution of the Martingale, we could price the log contract for that distribution, and that's what the black line shows. So in a continuous world, then the black line would represent the price of the variance swap. We don't want to think we're in a continuous world, so we want to ask, well, what happens when we allow for jumps? And the two blue lines give essentially the upper and lower bounds by the algorithm, by the calculations that I had on the blackboard that's disappeared there, for what the volatility price should be. The observant ones amongst you may notice there are two red lines. They don't really have any finance meaning. But if we go back to this problem and replace the word minimized by maximized, it turns out that Azamayor does the trick for that thing. And so although there's no financial meaning for the red lines, one can always plot them anyway just for one's own interest. And that's what the red lines are, for my interest anyway. Sometimes a bit hard to interpret that thing. So here's the same thing when I've divided through by the price of the log contract, or minus 2 times the log contract. So these are relative prices for the discontinuous world relative to what prices people would be charging if they use my definition, sorry, in the continuous world it's not a problem, if they use the standard definition of the log contract and its price. Okay, so as long as, so the only real issue is when we start getting out to plus 1, when we really work with the uniform minus 1 plus 1, and then this upper bound starts exploding. I show you the uniform because we can do explicit calculations for that thing. Of course, what you really want to do, perhaps, is a more realistic model. A more realistic model might be a log normal model. Okay, so what I've got on the horizontal axis is horizontal axis denotes volatility. Denotes, I think that should have said. Presumably, S and D are close to each other on the keyboard. Or I was completely wacko when I was doing that at 5 o'clock this morning. That's another possibility. So volatility on the horizontal axis. We've got the same 5 lines plotted. The only really important ones are the blue and the black line. Again, here's the relative price. Price of the variance swap under assumption of potential jumps, or rather bounds on the price of the variance swap under the assumption of potential jumps, relative to the price of the variance swap under the continuous model. So think back to Roger Lee's talk. So in Roger Lee's talk, he wasn't calibrating, well, he was sort of calibrating to the prices of log contracts, because he was working out the price for each of his Levy models of that log contract. So he was working out the price under Levy models of the variance swap. And what he was finding was that under your specific model, he got anything between a 5% and a 20% difference between the model price and between the Levy price and the continuous price. So, well, it depends where on my picture we want to look here as to whether that's good or bad. Clearly, as volatility gets high, I mean, 100% volatility is pretty high volatility. So if I was replotting this graph, I might show you between point 1 and point 4, where the numbers looked a lot better. I mean, we're still talking about maybe, more than 50% difference between the jump price and the non-jump price. But, I mean, this is how it is. I mean, if you're really worried about jumps, then this tells you how bad things can be. How good things can be. This is where you make your profits, actually, between trader prices and the real thing. This may not be the real thing, but it's some bound on the real thing. My time is just about up. I have a slide here about the good news. What have we done? We've taken the volatility swap, and we said, well, Neuberger appearance is beautiful stuff, but perhaps we want to ask the same question, but in the presence of jumps. I've said, well, you give me a set of calls with the same maturity as my variance swap, and I can tell you the worst case model, including jumps. I can describe it to you, I can draw pictures, I can calculate everything. In order to do this, I mean, I had this thing where I turned the integral of 1 over s squared, and various people have talked about weighted variance swaps. Well, certainly for some families of weighted variance swaps, you can do the same thing. I think more interesting is, suppose we had some forward start variance swap, then can we price that? So for that, we don't have the Brownian motion starting at 1, we have the Brownian motion starting with some intermediate law going through to some terminal law. Again, there's a lot to work out here, but I'm confident that I will be able to answer that question. And then, of course, if I can, I mean, I've shown you how to do the thing, started at a delta function, run through to some, I'm sorry, I should do it the other way, start at some delta function, run through to some law at time 1. If we can then do a general starting law at time 1, run through time 2, then I can glue the two bits together. There's linearity in the payoff, and therefore the worst case prices should just add to give you the worst case price. And in this case, so what that's going to mean is that if you think these bounds are rubbish, then, well, you give me some 6 months option prices, a full continuum of 6 month option prices, but you give me that extra information, I will be able to refine that bound. In principle, we can keep going further and further. We can get, in principle, I don't know, don't actually know if this is possible, but you give me a full double continuum of option prices without assuming any continuity. I could tell you what the best and worst case would be, and it would still be different to the prices under a continuity assumption, but presumably the bounds would come in. I have no idea how much. So this is the good news. I was prepared to put the good news on a slide. Bad news, nice mathematics, but it's sort of the wrong payoff, really. I mean, the VIX is about taking logs, and there is really an open question about can one go from my definition to perhaps what you might think the real definition. I think it's very unfortunate, actually, that they didn't use the Derman definition for the volatility swap. That would have made life so much. It's another example of where the finance industry has failed to choose the most attractive mathematical object, and they've chosen something crude, and we're suffering for it. But it leaves me with open questions to think about. I have some more bad news, but I think I've exhausted your patience already, and I will stop there. That was my second piece of bad news, actually. Right, so it's bad news in the sense I don't know. Okay, now, I've been working on this style of problem for many years, and in every case that I know of where people have been able to find the bounds in the style that I've got them, those bounds are enforceable in the sense that there is a hedging strategy, and if the bound is violated, the hedging strategy will generate you arbitrage profits, will generate a positive return at zero risk. I don't know yet how to do that for this example. I have a sneaking suspicion that it's not possible in this example. Because what goes wrong is that it's the switch from the X to S. Okay, there's some time change and there are potential jumps. Now, as soon as I'm in the S world, the Brownian motion world, I can, I haven't done it yet, but I'm confident I could write down the hedge. But that hedge potentially involves you changing your position as the Brownian motion moves, and you might not see that change in the Brownian motion in the X world, because that might disappear in the time change. Now, this may screw things up badly. Now, in one sense, that's bad news. In another sense, that's actually pretty good news. Okay, because, well, I mean, either way, I win. Okay? If there's a model-independent hedge of the sort you're looking for, then there's a wonderful model-independent hedge. You're happy, I'm happy. Okay? If, on the other hand, I can show that there is no model-independent hedge, then you're unhappy, but I'm pretty happy, actually, because this will be a first example where, in this style of problem, one had a duality gap between the primal pricing problem and the dual hedging problem. So I win either way. That's the sort of problem I like, provided I can answer the question, which I can't yet do. Well, I think I changed my mind continuously, or perhaps with jumps is a better way, about what the answer is going to be to that question. I mean, this is very, very much work in progress. This is the first time I've given this talk. These slides are, some of them are less than 12 hours old. I'm sure I'm going to talk about this later. Some of you may wish to be somewhere else at the time. Some of you may not be there where I'm talking about it. But those that get to hear this talk again, I am confident it will be different in some respects next time.